Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Sign up to be a paid member, get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and occasional exclusive bonus episodes that we'll make just for you. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com who makes this podcast possible.
So why don't you come out with it?
Because a burden shared may either be halved or doubled, depending on the heart that receives it.
Oh, foul edge, beard! Enough with the quail sauce! Give me the meat and give it to me raw.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV. I'm David Chen.
I'm John Marshall. You did not pick that line to introduce this podcast, David.
Welcome to today's discussion about Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power.
Literally tearing up right now.
Yeah, I mean that. But just so you know, that is what I say to Don before we begin every episode of this podcast. Give me the meat and give it to me raw. I'm talking about the meat of Tolkien's writing, of course.
Of course.
you okay there, Don?
You broke me. I thought you were going to do like a Gil Gallad line.
All right. Anyway.
Ooh, okay. Composure. Hi, everybody. I'm Don Marshall.
Today, we're going to be discussing Season 1, Episode 5 of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. The episode title is Partings. You can always find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. And find us on Twitter and YouTube at decodingtv. Don Marshall, before we dive into this week's episode of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, I wanted to react to some of the feedback and the tweets and such that we've received about some of our previous work. One of those things being about the multiple timelines theory that was put forward on the podcast last week. And so this theory runs along the lines of like, the Harfoot stuff feels very disconnected to the rest of the stuff that's happening in the show. This could just be because we're bouncing around different areas of Middle-earth, or it could be because it's taking place in a different time than when the rest of the events of the show take place. A lot of people objected to this timeline or to this theory, saying, hey, guys, I don't know if you saw in like episodes 1 and 2, everyone saw the meteor coming down from the sky, and therefore the meteor kind of joined them all into one world and one timeline. I brought this up to you, Don Marshall, and you had a really quick response to it, right, Don?
I did. Multiple meteors. And here's actually, we'll get into it when we get into the Southland stuff. I think I am even now more on board with the multiple timelines theory because of a very specific sequence of scenes that we see in a Galadriel Halbrand scene, as well as a Southland scene sort of mixing together.
I am actually, after this week's episode, less on board with the multiple timeline theory for reasons that we'll get into.
Let's talk about it. Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. And then there's one other thing I just wanted to mention real quick, Don, which is that this is a question I wanted to ask you for like the last month. But basically, in the first or second episode of the show, Elrond goes to Durin's home of Khazad Dûm and participates in a rock breaking competition. And he loses, and the punishment of losing is banishment from Khazad Dûm. But then Elrond is seen chilling and hanging out with Durin's family for a long time after that. What gives, Don? What do you think?
I think Durin just decided to change his mind. And that's, I'm chalking it up to just that. Nothing more, nothing less. It's like, he's a temperamental hothead. I guess the prince changed his mind. And hey, if Durin III, his dad, is okay with it, whatever.
Yeah. All right. Well, we did get that question a couple times, and I've been having it myself, so I thought, going to pop it to Don this week. But yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Of course, you can always tweet at us at DecodingTV on Twitter or email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Love the questions. Love the corrections and so on.
Yeah, please keep me honest.
Yes. Don, let's get into season one, episode 5 of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. Episode title, Partings. Overall thoughts on the episode, Don Marshall.
David Chen, I think that this was a 0 out of 10 because Deeza is not in it. And now for my actual thoughts. this episode, I went back and watched it a second time, and I liked it better the second time. I'm really loving the series so far. They're making some choices, and I think they're committing to those choices. I don't agree with all of them. I think they could probably do things a little differently, but I'm not going to say it's bad because I disagree with those choices, right? I don't think that makes it any less enjoyable for people that are, you know, haven't read the books or aren't as deep into the lore as I am. We did see a couple of really nice moments in the show that I think shows the potential of what this whole potential 5 seasons could be. We didn't see that sort of overall, for me at least, I felt like I didn't see that all the way through this episode. I'd probably say my favorite is still episode 4. I also had some questionable moments with the dwarves. It made a little bit more sense when I went back and watched it the second time. But overall, yeah, I thought it was an enjoyable episode. How about you?
This was a pretty rough one for me, Don Marshall. Not going to lie.
Yeah. No, I thought it might be.
and I have to say, like, I don't think I'm alone in that reaction. I've spoken with a few other people too. And I think that, like, this is probably one of the weakest episodes. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is like many of the plot beats feel like reiterated from last episode, or the show feels to some degree like it's spinning its wheels. The Galadriel Numenor storyline doesn't feel like it's advanced really very much from last episode. Same thing with the Harfoot storyline. Like, the stranger does more creepy things and we don't know who he is. And that's kind of it. That's kind of where we were last time we saw the stranger. You know, so I think that from a plot perspective, it didn't really feel like that much moved along. I will say there was individual sequences in the show that are really, really brilliant. Like when the Harfoots are traveling, which we're about to discuss, and there's all these aerial shots of them walking in this beautiful Middle Earth landscape, and you hear the singing.
It's so beautiful.
Like, that's kind of where I am with this episode, and to a lesser degree, like, the show as a whole, which is like individual sequences I find to be like heart-stoppingly gorgeous, beautiful, moving, really well done. How they all join together to have like narrative momentum going into the season, a little bit more of a question for me.
I'm the same way.
I think that the show is, and maybe we'll get to this a little bit more later, but I think that the show is simultaneously moving too quickly and not quickly enough.
No, I hear
you. Let me explain what I mean by that.
Yeah.
This episode ends with them kind of going off from Numenor to Middle Earth, right? And to fight the battles in the Southlands. It's a weird time for that to happen, in my opinion. Like, that moment to me feels like it should have happened either way earlier, so we could be part of the adventure earlier, because there's only 3 episodes left, or it should have been like the concluding moment at the end of season one, and that's kind of the cliffhanger, and then we spend season one involved in like the politics of Numenor and understanding more deeply what the relationship is between man and elves. What is it that people believe in terms of their religion or their feelings about the Valar, and whether or not they should be going to help the elves again. Like, all of these discussions should have taken place in a more drawn out way, so we could really feel the difference between these opinions and have them like battle each other out in a form of ideas. But instead, it's happened at a very awkward time. So it feels both too fast, in the sense that I feel like we didn't get, you know, we got a bunch of pronouncements about why people think we should go or shouldn't go. And then we ended up going. So it's too fast in that sense. It's too slow in the sense that I feel like there's not really enough episodes for this whole plotline to come to a satisfying conclusion by the end of season one.
Yeah, no, I agree with you wholeheartedly on that one. I think the pacing they're making very distinct choices. I don't necessarily agree with all of those choices. And I don't know if you were part of the whole like huge explosion of theories way back when the first trailer came out, but there were thoughts and theories about like, or actually, I guess this would even be way before the first trailer came out. Probably a couple months that, you know, they're going to focus on, you know, Elrond is going to be the focus in season one and we're going to see the Elf Kingdom, and then Galadriel is going to be all of season two and it's going to shift a little bit to like a more political Game of Thrones-y type, and then season three is going to be, you know, Mordor right. and coming together the dwarves, and there was all this speculation and they're sort of all doing it at once. But yeah, I'm definitely feeling like episode five, while I enjoyed it for those, like you said, individual moments, the sort of overarching story, I want to see them pick up the pace. I want to see it all sort of come together, and I'm sort of trying to embrace
it. It needs to be faster or slower. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes,
like
yes.
In my opinion, it needs to go faster and get us to the adventure, or go slower and really let us luxuriate in these dynamics of these different opinions that people have about this stuff. Mm-hmm. But anyway, let's dive into this in detail. So we started with the Harfoots, as I just mentioned. Nori and the stranger have a conversation where I guess she's teaching the stranger English or whatever it is, what's the language?
It's just the common tongue. Yeah.
The common tongue. Yeah. It's interesting. Obviously we're covering Andor here on Decoding TV podcast as well. And, there's a different language for like the language they speak in that show.
Arabic. Like, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
well, Basic, I think it's called like the Basic.
Oh,
is what's English.
I'm sorry. Yes. It's called Basic. Yeah.
It's called Basic in Star Wars is what English. And so in Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, it's the common tongue. So she's trying to teach, Gandalf the common tongue, and they're going through,
the stranger. We don't actually know it's Gandalf.
Oh, sorry.
Unless you know something I don't.
I don't know anything. She's teaching the stranger the common tongue, and she says, you know, there's peril on the road, and he says, I'm peril, maybe hinting at the fact that he might become a danger for them. And then there's like a beautiful travel montage that's just like it's like one of the best sequences I've seen in a TV show all year. Like just
easily.
Like beautiful scenery and beautiful music, and I'm just like, this is incredible. This is amazing.
Megan Richards with this Wandering Day song. Just, I've listened to that probably like 100 times already. It's gorgeous. Also, sorry, I do a quick correction. Arabesh is the written language in Star Wars that we see. And so I just, you know, I'm a Star Wars nerd, so I know I don't want the nerds to question my sci-fi experience as well.
No, they would never. They would never, Don. Okay, so then we see a group of like people wearing white armor with like white hair or no hair, short hair. And they show up at the site of the meteor landing that contained the stranger in it. And they're inspecting things. And I think a lot of people thought this might have been Sauron when this was in the trailers, right?
Yeah. So this is actually if I'm remembering correctly, this is Birdie Season. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly. And in the trailer that they released for Comic-Con, there was this assumption that this character that Birdie is playing is Sauron. And everyone was up in arms. It's like, why'd they turn Sauron into Eminem? I was trying to not necessarily do damage control, but like, everybody chill. It's almost certainly not Sauron, and if it is, I mean, the showrunners have been hinting that, like, maybe we've already seen Sauron, and they're just like, listen, I don't want to. We could have a whole bonus episode about theories.
Is there any way you can tell us why you think this isn't Sauron without spoiling anything?
So this is actually one of the fun parts that I really like about this show, is that for me, they're keeping me in the dark too, because there's no lore associated with this. There were servants of Sauron and servants of Morgoth that, you know, in secret, in the dark, tried to like keep his power and bring him back, but we don't really get a lot of detail. We didn't know if they somehow turned their hair blonde or whatever, so no, I can't really tell you what this is, other than it's probably a servant of Sauron or Morgoth in some way or another.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. Well, Don, you also think that this scene gives more credence to the idea that the stranger is not Gandalf and possibly a Balrog.
Yeah. I do. I'm starting to think that we're going to have a little bit more of a bait and switch in either these last three episodes where sort of the timelines and or plot lines converge, or we're going to have a couple of big twists. We're going to find out who Sauron is. We're going to find out who Adar is. We're going to find out who the Balrog is. And to me, the fact that these evil people are searching for the stranger leads me to believe that if he doesn't have a memory, he's going to remember that he's bad, and you know that's going to overtake him some way or another. I'm still, I will say, hesitant, but this made me a little bit more sure that, like, yeah, this isn't going to end well.
Right, because why would they be? First of all, these people wearing all the white clothing, they look evil, certainly.
They do. Right? They do.
They don't look welcoming.
No.
And why would they be looking for him unless he was originally part of their crew or useful to them in some way? It does seem to lend credence to the concept that maybe the stranger is not completely benevolent.
Yeah.
So
I do also like, I kind of, in a way, I'm almost a little bit disappointed because I think the idea of like a non-binary actor playing Sauron, like, could be a very interesting choice. Like, I don't know if you've seen the Tilda Swinton, Bob Dylan movie.
Yeah. I think
what's it called?
I'm Not There. Is that what it's called? Yeah.
I think Tilda Swinton would make an excellent Sauron because
I'm pretty sure it was Kate Blanchett that was in that movie.
Was it Kate Blanchett?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm Not There. This is the Todd Haynes movie that is about Bob Dylan. Yeah.
Oh God. Oh no. Who am I thinking of then? Okay, never mind. We can totally wrong person. Anyway, all of this is to say, I think having this sort of androgyny and you know, mystery surrounding who Sauron is and who these people are adds to sort of the flavor of this Middle Earth adaptation that we're getting.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll see. You are fully off the Stranger's Gandalf train at this point.
I don't know if I'm off. I'd say I'm 70-30.
70-30
Balrog.
Yeah. 70-30 in favor of it's a Balrog. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So then the Harfoots are attacked by wolves. And the stranger intervenes and picks one of them off before one of them eats Nori. And then he Hulk smashes the ground, as you put it in the show notes, scares the wolves off, but is himself injured by it. Mm-hmm. And anyway, he's again showing his utility to the Harfoots. I will say, by the way, that one of the things that has been mentioned in favor of the stranger being Gandalf is the idea that all these adventures he's going on with the Harfoots might demonstrate why Gandalf has such an affection for the Hobbits later on in the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Yeah.
And also the Hobbit trilogy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think
that does seem to be the most Occam's razor easiest explanation.
I'm a sucker for a twist every once in a while when they sweep the legs out from under me. But yeah, that's probably what's right. I don't know if you picked up on this. There was a really cool detail when the stranger does the Hulk smash. He hits the ground and the wolves go flying. And the wolf that hits one of his, I think it's the back left leg, starts limping with the back left leg as if that is the one that's injured. I don't know why I picked that up, but I looked at that and I went, oh, that was just like a neat little CGI detail. Like they noticed what part of the body got hit. They made that part of the body injured and then limped away. I have my own theory about the wolves though.
Tell me about your theory about the wolves in this episode of Rings of Power.
I won't say this is my theory entirely. This was actually shown to me on Twitter by someone that goes by @HiggyBaby. So @HiggyBaby has a theory. We see the cultists tracking the Meteor Man. There are three of them. They appear over a cliff. And then we see three wolves. Now, there are shapeshifters. There are werewolves in the Silmarillion. They are hinted at. We don't get a lot of detail about them. They're sort of talked about in very broad strokes. But I like the Higgy Baby's theory on Twitter that this may potentially be a shape-shifting group of cultists that can turn into werewolf people. Mm,
perhaps. We'll find out. It's the Higgy Baby, by the way. Yes, it is the Higgy Baby. All right. So Stranger comes in, saves them. There's a scene where he kind of puts himself in this water, but then it becomes ice. Unclear what he's saying. Nori comes in to try to pull his hand out of the ice, but then ends up getting her hand frozen herself. And then he kind of pulls out. There's this big blast, and she's thrown clear and then runs away. It's kind of scary. I was worried that Nori was going to lose her hand in that scene.
You know, I think it would have been very Game of Thrones of them to just straight up have one of the main characters lose her arm in episode five.
Yeah.
Certainly would have made for some character development, but given their level of like medicine and skill, I feel like Nori wouldn't survive that. So,
anything else you want to say about this whole Harfoot sequence of this episode? I'm still enjoying the Harfoot stuff just because... Mm-hmm. To me, the stuff that feels the most connected with the lore, honestly, is the stuff that I am least connecting with as a viewer. The Harfoot stuff feels like it's its own adventure just happening on its own. And, oh, we're learning about the society. And yeah, I'm still interested and invested in this. The Galadriel stuff feels like it's moving along because the plot needs to move it in a certain way.
Yeah.
And that to me, you know, that's what, you know, I know people differ in their opinion on this, but that's my feeling. I will say it's a chilling moment when that woman was talking with the guy in charge of the Harfoots and was like, we should have just left them behind. It's like, Jesus, these people are cold blooded, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a brutality.
We should have just left them to die. It's like, okay, I guess. Anyway, any other thoughts on this Harfoot stuff?
I want to give a huge shout out to Megan Richards, who sang the song. I think this Wandering Day is rivaling the Pippin Home is Behind song. Obviously not in the same like emotional weight, because the Pippin song in Return of the King is very sad. And this is, again, just going along with that mentality that you taught me, David, no thoughts, just vibes. And the landscape of New Zealand, right? The landscape shots are beautiful. The little montage of the travel. I was a little bit worried we were just going to like watch them travel for five seasons in like a very, a very boring Mad Max Fury Road, but with hobbits. And
that actually sounds pretty awesome. I'm just gonna put that out there.
I mean, I'd watch it, but I don't think the Tolkien estate would let us do that. But yeah, no, I really loved the song. I do feel like this is part of what we were saying before, where we're kind of spinning our wheels a little bit with the actual story, because we know with the Stranger, he's got the magic. It was not really anything that needed to. I almost feel like this could have been in the last episode. Episode 4, where we didn't see the Harfoots, and we could have maybe or like condensed it. Not all of the scenes felt necessary, but you know, again, this is no fault of the actors or anything, but just I think the pacing is a little
not much new happens for the Harfoots this episode.
No, basically.
Nori almost loses her hand. The Stranger learns some common tongue. That's basically it. So
my great thumb.
All right.
That's what he says instead of migration. I thought that was kind of funny.
Let's talk about the Elrond storyline.
Yeah.
So I'm enjoying the Elrond Durin stuff because Elrond and Durin are such different characters in physical appearance, in style, you know, and just seeing two characters that are different kind of interact and have a dynamic. It's just like inherently interesting, I think. So they're having dinner. And Gil-galad asks Durin about, hey, what are you guys mining for down there? And Durin gets really, he bristles at this question, and he kind of returns by like saying like, hey, where'd you get this table? Because it's like this really rare mineral that only can be found in certain places, and it's basically sacred. You guys basically committed sacrilege here. And so kind of puts them on the defensive. It's a really, I enjoy the scene. It's like a fun, you know, power move that Durin is making amongst the elves, and I appreciated it. Any thoughts on the dinner scene before we move on?
I thought the dinner scene was pretty well constructed. The elves to me here strike me as a little bit less sort of fair and regal than they're described elsewhere, especially in the books, but like also very much like kind of power hungry still a little bit, like the desire to maintain the realm. It felt very sort of like Game of Thrones style conversation, Downton Abbey dinner table discussions, where like lots of things are going on around the dinner table where all of these people are sort of competing for their own best interests and trying to sort of one up each other. Meanwhile, you've got Elrond, who is like the, oh God, Michael from Arrested Development, trying to bring everybody together, you know?
Exactly right.
And it just kind of it kind of strikes me that like the dynamics are really cool here. I do think it maybe I would have done it a little bit differently, but this is just me personally as a lore nut. I would have liked to have seen sort of the goodwill between the dwarves and the elves carry over from Elrond to Gil-galad, and then maybe like. Maybe the elves push too far a little bit later. It strikes me as like there's a lot of political intrigue here, but I kind of would have liked to see Elrond succeed. But as it turns out, he has been more or less double crossed by everybody,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or at least kept in the dark, I would say.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. There's a scene afterwards with Gil-galad and Elrond.
Mm-hmm.
Gil-galad talks to Elrond and questions him, and he asks him to recount a story. Can you tell us about this, Don Marshall?
Yes. So this is a Amazon lore, we'll call it. They're making up a sort of origin for Mithril. And I actually quite like the idea of having lore within, you know, a mythos within a mythology that is Lord of the Rings. Like, of course, the elves have their own mythology. This is what's known as the Song of the Roots of Hithaiglir. This is, according to Elrond, apocryphal. So I think it kind of feels like the writers wrote that as like, hey, listen, we know we're making this up. It's definitely not true. This is not how Mithril was created. Just let us have this cool CGI moment of a Balrog and an elf fighting in front of a cool tree. So I do actually want to point out a fun detail before we get to the story. Gil-galad says, recount it, Elrond Peredel. And Peredel means half elven. And so it is almost like an insult, because I read it as an insult because Elrond is half elven. His father is human, and his mom was an elf. And Gil-galad almost feels as though he is saying, like, you are half elf. Don't call yourself a full elf here. I'm in charge. Almost like a power move,
basically.
And
because he needs Elrond to do something for him.
And it's basically like, I am
what
king.
That is, I'm confused about, but we'll talk about that after this. Yeah. But
anyway. I'm sorry, I apologize. Elrond's dad is also half elf as well, but he is also half elfin. But yeah, that is sort of their sort of origin of Mithril. Cool visuals. Not really necessary. I mean, you could have just kind of kept it as like Mithril. It's a mineral that grows in the ground. And then they have this sort of like big reveal that the tree is dying.
Well, yeah, and the story he tells is like there is a battle between an elf and a Balrog, and from their conflict, you know, their conflict seeped into this tree and into the ground, and that's how it became Mithril, right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember Mithril in the Lord of the Rings trilogy being pretty cool, but this really does give it a whole other dimension of like, wow, it is this kind of impenetrable, extremely highly valued element.
Yeah.
That does make those movies richer, you know, in my opinion. So,
yeah, no, I agree. I think the, just to kind of give you an idea of how tough it is or how powerful it is, there's a line in the Fellowship of the Ring, the Mithril shirt that Frodo wears is worth the entirety of everything in the Shire, according to Gandalf. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing. But this was a complete show invention and you were cool with it because
yeah. It's a nice little bit of like, I mean, they kind of acknowledge that like, yeah, we made this up. It's an apocryphal myth. There's no way to confirm it's true. Right. So I kind of like that they own up to it. It's like, yeah, we're making it up, but if it's cool, you let it slide. And I'm just like, mm-hmm. All right, you're making a choice. Let's go with it.
Gil-galad shows Elrond one of the trees is dying. It has this kind of pestilence on it, this blight. An outer manifestation of inner turmoil is what he refers to it as. And that basically evil is on the up and up. And Mithril is potentially our way to stop it, right?
Yeah. So this is, I think, a nod to what's known as the Long Defeat. The elves in Middle-earth that didn't go back to the Undying Lands after the war ended are basically fighting a war they know that they're not going to win. It was like that in the First Age where they're like, yeah, we're trying to fight against Sauron's master, but he's really strong. We just keep, you know, losing and losing and losing. We need help. And then Second Age, and it just keeps, they keep losing and losing and losing. And the elves kind of at this point are realizing like, we need something to change all of that. And I have some potential theories about what this is sort of leading to if we want to get into it.
Well, they say that they need the Mithril to potentially help stop the spread of evil, right? Mm-hmm. That the Mithril will help them like get back the light, right? The Eldar, is that right?
So the Valar, the Eldar the Eldar means children of the stars. That's the word the elves have for themselves. The Valar are basically the gods of this universe.
Okay, got it. And at the same time, we also know that they're working on this forge to make what I assume will be the titular Rings of Power.
Yeah, this is kind of where I think the showrunners are going. It was crafted in a way that when I watched it the first time, I was like, wait, hang on, what? But this definitely feels like they are leaning towards a plot line where the dwarves mine the Mithril, give some to the elves potentially use some of that Mithril to craft the sort of elven rings. Maybe we see it in the last episode of season one or the beginning of season two. And then those rings are used, as mentioned in the Fellowship of the Ring movies, to like maintain the kingdoms of elves.
Are all the rings made of Mithril, or do we not know what the rings are made of, or do some of the rings have different makeups?
If I'm remembering this correctly, and I apologize if I get this wrong, I'm sure we'll get an email about it next week or a comment. I believe not all of them are made entirely of Mithril. I think Elrond's is gold with a sapphire inlay. I think
I just like the fact that some of the rings are made of this completely indestructible product that is fictional and magical. And then some of them are just gold with a little jade in it, a little sapphire, maybe some opal.
I think they might try and like infuse the Mithril with the rest of the metals. I don't know. I'll see where they go with it.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe we'll follow up on this. But suffice to say, maybe the Mithril will be, you're saying maybe the Mithril will be used to make the rings? Is that what you're saying?
That's where I think they're going. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll see. Now, here's where I get really confused about this episode, mm-hmm. Don Marshall, is that there is this conversation where Gil-galad says, hey, if you know anything about Mithril, you gotta tell me, because the whole kingdom depends on it. And then Elrond's like, well, I swore I would keep the whole stuff going on in the mountain secret. And I can't break my oath to a friend. You know, that's pretty uncool. And Gil-galad's like, okay, but like, just so you know, the fate of the universe literally depends on it, you know? And then at that point, I'm like, what is the secret? Is it like where the Mithril is located? Is it that they are mining for Mithril at all? Because the fact that Elrond is being so cagey about it should be an indication that there is freaking Mithril in Khazad Dûm. You know what I mean? Like any normal human person analyzing the situation would be like, Elrond's not saying that there's Mithril there. That's, you watch the scene, you're like, there's Mithril there, and he's not saying it. Why is the secret, like, what is the nature of the secret that Elrond is keeping, or what is the nature of the oath, in your opinion, Don Marshall?
Oaths are really important in Tolkien, and to me, just full disclosure right up front, I don't know. This is one of those parts that I don't think made much sense to me watching it the first time. I'm like, wait, I don't know if I agree with this direction that they're going. But it definitely is important when it comes to oaths. There was something back in the first age known as the Oath of Feanor, and that's when all a bunch of the elves swore to go and fight Sauron's master. It's basically the whole prologue of that first episode of Rings of Power. And when you break oaths in Tolkien's universe, it can have some pretty disastrous consequences depending on what you swear by. Remember in the Two Towers, Gollum swears on the ring, right? And there's so many, oaths that are made that if you break it, bad things are going to happen, whether the gods are going to sort of like smite you where you stand or cause something bad to happen, or you meet with a terrible doom. But I think the showrunners are trying to go with a more, Elrond is in the same position his dad is, in that he is the only one that can save the world. Which is a choice, not necessarily something I think is the strongest choice, but they are committing to it. And I don't mind it
as a choice. I just wish it was better. Like if they had just said, we need to know where the Mithril is, we know there's Mithril in the mountain. Maybe you know where it is and you need to tell us. And he's like, I can't tell you, that would make more sense to me, but it's just like, I think he's just keeping a secret of that there is Mithril, which is more confusing to me. If they just said like location of it, that would make it a little more clear. And maybe that is what it eventually is going to be,
I hope that there's a line in the next three episodes that clears that up, but I think like the way they phrased it this episode was a little
it's a little vague. Anyway,
bit of a miss there.
So Elrond also talks to Celebrimbor, who knew about the Mithril from the start, and that's why he sent Elrond in to kind of see if there might be Mithril, kind of, I guess. Mm-hmm, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I have another theory that I actually...
What is going on here?
I didn't put this in the show notes, but I, if it's all right, I'd like to maybe go into this a bit more.
Why not?
Here's my next theory. The elves are being stupid. Celebrimbor is just being really weird to me, and Gil-galad has the weight of the elven kingdom on his shoulders and is acting very much like, I am deep in the darkness, kind of like moody. I have this theory that I feel like maybe Celebrimbor is already being influenced by sort of maybe it's the blight of the trees or the evil that has happened. Because to me, it seems like and maybe it's not. Maybe I'm just trying to explain away bad writing and people are going to call me a shill in the comments. That's fine. But it strikes me that like this is an interesting choice they're going with. And I can't help but wonder if the reason behind that is because there is something else at play here.
Mm-hmm. As to why Celebrimbor like hid the concept of the Mithril from Elrond.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Here is my kind of, I don't want to go too much into this, just what I'm about to say, because we have other things to talk about. But like, did you see Top Gun Maverick, Don Marshall?
I did not.
Okay. Well, Top Gun Maverick is a great movie. And the reason it's a great movie is because at no point in the movie are you confused about what is happening, right? at the beginning of the movie, they're like, hey, you need to do this mission. And they explain all the parameters of the mission at the beginning of the movie. And then the whole movie, they're preparing for the mission. It's like, here's the mission. And they reiterate, by the way, in case you forget, the mission is this. Don't forget the mission. This is the mission. Here's what you need to do the mission. And then at the end of the movie, they do the mission. I'm not going to say what happens to the mission. Like, I won't say who lives or dies or whether they succeed or not. But they go and attempt the mission. At no point are you confused about what's happening, right? They're either everyone's talking about the mission, or they're thinking about the mission, or they're doing the mission. That's literally the whole movie, right? I think Rings of Power could take some lessons from that movie, because I'm like, okay, so what was Elrond doing in the first scene, in the first two episodes anyway? He was going in to ask if Durin could help with the tower, like their labor to help with the tower. But then like then the next time we see the tower, it's like midway complete. And then Durin is doing this other stuff. He's mining for mithril. And it's like, okay, so is he not working on the tower anymore? Like, and then it's like, well, when we sent you in there, we knew that there was already mithril and we needed it. And it's like, okay, so were you hoping that Elrond would find the mithril, or was that not even in the realm of possibility? You know, so I'm just like, what was Elrond doing in the first two episodes when it comes to Durin? It just is a little bit.
It's disjointed. It definitely feels. And look, I absolutely adore all of the Elrond Durin Disa scenes. I think Sofia Nonvita is doing an amazing job. When she is on screen, she captures it, and the chemistry between them is great.
I love it. Yeah.
Overall plot of this, though, demands some thought, and you kind of gotta. It feels like they're asking you to do a couple of more mental gymnastics than you normally would in a no thoughts, just vibes kind of way that the Harfoots are.
In a thing that feels like it should be like relatively straightforward, which is, hey, we need Durin to do X. Mm-hmm. We need you to get Durin to do X. And by the way, we're hoping that in doing so, you will also discover Y or something, you know. Something like that, but like it feels just a little bit more muddled than that. Maybe it's super clear to everyone else who's watching, but the storytelling is a little bit, yeah. Anyway,
it could be a little bit clearer, I think. Yeah. But yeah,
all right. So Elrond speaks to Durin, finds out he's lying about the table. That's hilarious.
Dace has been wanting a new table.
Yeah, it's funny stuff. And then basically Elrond says, "Hey, we need the mithril, and I need to know if I can break the oath of not." Talking about the mithril. And so Durin says, all right, let's go. We'll see if we can get permission from my dad about it. So then that's the Elrond Durin storyline. So any other thoughts on this? It's a lovely scene between them. I love the chemistry between them. Great, great actors, great performances. Anything else?
You really want to skip over the give me the meat and give it to me raw line? We're just going to gloss right over that.
I don't think we have glossed over it. But I think we already reacted to that one.
That's, you know, I have this horrible feeling that that's going to become the I hate sand of the Lord of the Rings universe.
That's the question, is like, when a line like that happens in the show, do you think the showrunners knew what they were doing?
Absolutely.
I think so.
Absolutely. And yeah. It's like, you know, sorry. Let's move on. Okay. I'm not going to make it. All right. We continue.
All right. But there is also this dynamic where Durin's like, hey, I'm the one who holds all the keys here. You know, like,
yeah.
Me, little old me, please repeat that five times.
It's a nice little back and forth.
Yes. So, and that is the Elrond Durin storyline. Before we move on, Don Marshall, I do want to ask you, if people are enjoying our scintillating chats here on Decoding TV, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
I am Don Marshall. I go by DonMarshall72 across all of my social media platforms, and that is my main one on TikTok. I am also on YouTube and Instagram, as well as Twitter and Twitch. I also have a Patreon where we do some live streams. And also want to just give a huge shout out to everyone that has sort of been a part of the community in the last 2 weeks since the Hobbits War, the merchandise. The response has been amazing, and we are in the midst of totaling up the amount that we are going to be raising for charities. And it's a lot. It's a lot. We've got a lot. So thank you. I want to give a huge thank you again to everybody here.
That's awesome. And if you want to hear the backstory behind what Don just said, check out the video and also podcast episode on Decoding TV. I want to give a quick shout out to this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. We're also covering other shows, including She-Hulk as well as Andor. And acastofkings.com is a Decoding TV podcast covering House of the Dragon. Check that out. Finally, a big shout out to Episodic Medium, a great newsletter that I'd recommend. If you're enjoying listening to podcasts, watching YouTube videos, you also want to read about the shows that we're talking about, check out episodicmedium.substack.com. A great resource with awesome writers there. But yeah, those are some plugs we want to give you before we move on with what's going on in the Southlands and Numenor this week.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
All right, folks. Southlands. I guess Bronwyn is in charge now?
But yeah, anyway, I guess so. You know, I mean, that's fine. She killed the orc. Nobody was listening to her, and now they're listening to her. And it's they don't really seem to have any kind of like
a hierarchy or leader.
Hierarchy,
there's no mayor of the Southlands that's like directing everything. But anyway, there is this nice creepy scene between an orc and Adar, who he's looking at the sun and he's like, "Hey, do me a favor, give me your arm, you know,
give me your hand if we be friends." And Robin shall respond. That's Shakespeare. Sorry. And then the blisters pop out.
Anytime a villain says, "Give me your hand," like physically, don't do it.
Don't do it.
They're going to stab it. They're going to do something bad to it. Or in this case, let it bake in the sun until like these boils come. It's disgusting. It's really upsetting. But I think Adar is reflecting on how he's going to miss this warmth, because I guess whatever he's doing next is going to block out the sun in some way. Right. Is kind of my interpretation of it.
I got my theories on that, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll find out. But and he's like, I just want to see how the sun reacts to this guy's skin. So I know what I'm going to be missing later. Anyway, he's not a nice guy.
No, no, he's just bad.
Bronwyn tries to rally the people, but she kind of presents the dilemma that they have, which is we either got to swear fealty to this person and or vacate. Like those are the two options. And she's like, who wants to like fight these people? And a bunch of people's hands go up. And then this other guy, Waldrig, is like, I don't.
Yeah.
One thing you can say about the ancestors, they were our ancestors and they were alive, you know, which I thought was a great line. I'm like, yeah, okay. There's a kind of logic to that. And he says, let's go and surrender to these people because at least then we'll live. And I have to say, it's not unconvincing. Waldrig's like, I could totally see why Waldrig would want to do what he's doing in this episode, right?
Yeah, this is, I think, one of the more believable parts of this whole world, where there is such a conflict between like, yeah, let's just surrender to the guy. He's not gonna kill us if we bend the knee, to borrow a Game of Thrones term. But you know, there might be some sacrifices made along the way. Later.
So they show up at Adar's. Oh, and they also, it's disclosed that the tunnel is complete, right? I guess the tunnel being to the tower is what they're going to, or is it? I wasn't sure about where the tunnel is going to.
That is sense? Unclear, but I have a
certainly it goes by the tower.
Goes by the tower. Have a sneaking suspicion that the reason they are digging it is not just because they are trying to stay out of the sun. I think there's, can I potentially do a slight spoiler theory?
Hit us. Okay.
I think that we are about to see the creation of Mordor in a very real way. Because you will remember back in episode 4, when everybody was coming to the tower, Bronwyn has a very particular one-off line. It's like, that makes every village from here to Orodruin. Orodruin is Mount Doom. But they call it Orodruin. It's not called Mount Doom yet, right? Because it's just a mountain at this point. And the theory is that one of the mountains sort of in the distance may be Mount Dooms. I don't know if that's just something that, you know, the writers threw in there as an Easter egg and I'm reading too much into it, or what the deal is. But I have a feeling that there's more at play here. And maybe I'm wrong and I'm just trying to explain it away. But
Mordor is basically Sauron's home in...
Yes.
It's where Mount Doom and Mordor are basically the same place. Is that right?
Kind of, yeah. Mordor is just sort of that, if you look at a map of Middle-earth, it's that bottom right corner that's sort of sectioned off by the mountain ranges. And parts of it are, we see in the movie, covered in ash and soot and the volcanoes exploding all the time. But not all of it is. There's a place called, I believe it's the Sea of Nornen, which is a lake or a sea, excuse me. It's a sea in... the sort of southeastern part of Middle-earth, and there's farmland, and that's where Sauron keeps all of his captured warriors and the villagers to basically be the slaves of to provide food and all of the sort of necessary things to keep an army.
Yeah, but for the purpose, they're roughly in the same area. Is that accurate to say? Got it. All right, so we'll see if this ties into a big Fellowship of the Ring plotline / location.
Yeah.
The part where Waldrick and his companion show up to swear fealty to Adar is actually really cool. Like the way the music is done and they kind of all bow down. It's really like...
It's haunting. I think Bear McCreary did a great job constructing that scene as a way to sort of say, all right, cool. There were humans that did swear fealty to evil. Here's what happened. And it's very haunting.
Waldrick pledges his loyalty to Sauron, and that does not make Adar happy, because I don't know if you're aware of this, but Adar is not Sauron, and does not like to be mistaken for such. So
Waldrick speaks for all of us. You are Sauron, are you not? And it's like, I don't know, dude. He might be.
Really? Because he's an elf. Because I don't think so. If Sauron was an ex-elf, you would probably know about it, right?
Yeah.
And then he forces Waldrick to kill this guy named Rowan, who is... what was Rowan's relationship to Waldrick?
I don't know if they're related
or
anything.
Was he just another townsperson?
I think it's just... Yeah, this is Theo's friend that went with him.
Right.
The sword.
Yeah.
The same kid keeps popping up. But I have... there's a nice little sort of callback to both Tolkien and to the Peter Jackson movies. Tolkien has this thing where he likes to set up a plot point and then immediately cut away to it. It happens at the end of the Aragorn portion of Return of the King, where, you know, Pippin is fighting in Mount Doom outside the Black Gate of Mordor, and then immediately it cuts to Frodo. Peter Jackson did this in the Two Towers movie, where Merry and Pippin see this giant white figure. You think it's Sauron, and then immediately cuts to someone else. And so I think this feels like a little bit of a misdirection. I don't necessarily think that Rowan is dead yet.
Yeah, because you see him approaching Rowan, about to stab him, and then it cuts away. So maybe Rowan's still alive. Very possible. Yeah. We then cut to a conversation between Theo and his would-be stepdad, Arondir.
Maybe it's his dad. We still haven't seen Theo's ears. We still have not seen Theo's ears yet.
And Theo is not feeling great about stuff. And he is talking to Arondir about how, like, why are you even helping us? Like, elves, you've policed us for centuries, and now, like, the evil's finally here. We're never going to be able to triumph. And Arondir tries to kind of, like, rally him. And that's when Theo presents him with this weird blade that he has, this weird sword.
I love the fact that a teenager made a smart decision in this show. Like, that, like, finally, right? Like, I feel like there are so many TV shows, movies, comic books, whatever you want to call it, the teenager does something stupid. You know, don't go into that room in the horror movie. The killer's definitely in there. I'm just like, show them what you have. And he does. And it's not like kept secret and some big reveal to everybody. Like, Theo makes a good decision. Hats off to Theo.
Yeah. I'm going to be honest. It caught me a little off guard. You know, I was like, huh, like I didn't expect them to resolve the Theo. This felt like a thing that was going to take till episode like 7 or 8 before it was resolved. But they took care of it in episode 5. It was surprising to me. That's all I'll say. Arendi is like, hey, wait a second, this sword resembles a sculpture in the wall of this watchtower, and concludes that it is key to whatever the enemy is building next, basically, this blade that they have, and that's why they need to come get it. So anyway, any other major plot points or storylines to bring up about this particular stuff happening in the Southlands, Don?
No, I liked the Southlands stuff. It wasn't like it wasn't the crazy stuff we saw in like episode 3 with Arondir in the sort of pit digging it out. I would love to see Ismael Cruz Cordova get way more screen time. I think he is doing a really great job as Arondir. He feels very elven to me. Like he exudes that sort of elven presence. I think he's doing a great job.
Agreed. All right. Finally, the Numenor stuff. Let's get to it, right? So as
subplot hell, as we call it,
last episode, they had agreed, the Queen Regent had said, hey, we're going to Middle Earth. Numenor, we're sailing off to Middle Earth. And everyone apparently went from we should never intermix with elves or help them to, all right, fine, let's definitely go. Right. Because they're able to according to Elendil, they're able to easily fill up 5 ships. And in fact, Isildur really wants to be on the ship. And Elendil is like, I don't think you're quite ready. I mean, were you in the Sea Guard? Ooh, still fresh. Still fresh.
Yeah, that was harsh. That was harsh, Dad. Come on.
Yeah. This episode also deals like more with Halbrand hemming and hawing about whether or not he wants to do this. We do see that he's actually forging weapons. That seems to be his happy place. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait, how did that all work out? But then it's answered later in the episode that basically, Don, you had pointed out last episode that I guess they not only let Halbrand go, they gave him a guild crest for telling them where Galadriel was going. So, wow, really, really, that was an amazing plea deal that Halbrand struck.
Yeah, really, got out of jail, got a job, and all he had to do was give up this person he met a week ago.
Give up a location that they probably would have figured out, 10 minutes after they actually figured it out, but whatever. I don't know what the Numenorean justice system is like, so who knows? he has some tense conversations with Galadriel about who's using who, because Halbrand is like, I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back to the Southlands. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. I'm cool here, forging my swords. Like, I'm happy here. And Galadriel's like, well, hey, FYI, like, a lot of people are, going back because of you, and so you better make this look good. And it's tense. It's tense. So any thoughts about Halbrand's arc in this episode?
Halbrand's arc was kind of interesting in this one because we do sort of towards the end of it see the blacksmith or not the blacksmith, the forge scene. We see that forge scene where he and Galadriel are having that conversation. It's like, why are you so reluctant? Why do you keep fighting Galadriel? And I quite liked that scene. I will, if it's all right, kind of bring up the sort of intercutting of two specific scenes that we see that have to do with Halbrand. So we see Halbrand in the forge talking about the things he did in the Southlands to survive. It's like, you don't know who I was before, or what is it? You don't know what I did before I ended up on that raft. You don't know how I survived. We immediately cut to the Southlands and see Waldric and Rowan and the rest of the Southlanders bending the knee to Adar. So
in fact it was so weird that they cut to that scene in that moment, because when they cut to it, it was slow motion, I believe.
Yeah
And it made it feel like it was actually a flashback. So
didn't it feel like a flashback there, David? Didn't it just feel like a flashback?
So what's your theory there, Don Marshall?
I had a theory for about 10 seconds that maybe Halbrand was Rowan, and then Rowan almost gets, again, we don't see the body.
You are so far into this multiple timeline theory,
deep,
dude.
Way too deep into it, David. If I'm wrong, I'm just going to just sit there with my head in my hands. Like, what was it all for?
But we've only been talking about it for like 2 episodes worth of podcasts. So it's not, you're not that far deep, but I think here's my take on it. I'm just gonna put this out there too, is I think that, this is episode 5. Mm-hmm. By episode 7, I think we will know whether the Southland stuff is the same as, yeah. you know, is in the same yeah. timeline. And it feels to me really like they're setting it up so that the Numenoreans will come and save the Southlanders from Adar. Like, that's mm-hmm. in a conventional show, that is what we believe is happening, right? Mm-hmm. Is the Numenoreans are coming to save the Southlands. Now, I think that is in fact what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
You believe maybe multiple timelines, maybe we're actually seeing Hal Brand's origin story. That is possible. I'm not going to say it's impossible. But I would say it's quite a bit of a stretch based on what the show has shown us thus far, especially with the things you'd have to believe for that to happen. Multiple meteors.
I know.
Hal Brand's name is actually Rowan. You know, Hal Brand used to be friends with Theo. Like all these things you'd have to. Rowan actually survives that scene. You know, like all these things you have to believe for your theory to be true.
It's a stretch. Yeah. It's a stretch.
Yeah.
I love
it's
it.
It's a
though.
Stretch.
This is half the fun, right? There's uh-huh, actually uh-huh. five meteors, and there's a sixth we didn't see. Or it's often that, like, no, just the ridiculousness. I recognize that, but half of that is, you know, obviously I don't believe nearly all of these theories equally. And my thing in TV is, right, if I don't see the body, I don't think the character is dead.
Yes,
it's just my. That's just me, though.
You're like, I'm just a simple man with simple pleasures. Like, I want to see a dead body when a character dies.
Well, when you put it like that, David.
Okay. God. So there is a training montage where Galadriel needs to train people on how to fight orcs. I thought this was really, it's really well done. You know, like, I don't know that it adds anything to the story. Like, it doesn't move the plot. Like, she's not, like, teaching them super useful information. But it's really well done. It's like, it looks like she actually did it. It looks like they're actually like physically making it's really, I love it. We've seen a lot of scenes like this, you know?
Yeah.
In Game of Thrones, there's a character called Cyril Pharrell that kind of did a similar thing with, although using real blades, that was the thing that really threw me. I'm like, dude, use wooden
were they using
swords.
Real blades?
It looked like they were using real blades.
I just assume they're using dulled edge blades. So they get the weight right. Cause when you fight with like a wooden sword, you don't get the right. I used to, I did like some stage acting stuff.
They use dulled edge blades in a way. You're definitely right, Don Marshall, because they probably used dulled edge blades when they shot it. So,
yeah.
Anyway, great sequence. And, Galadriel's a badass, and reinforces that, you know?
Morvith Clark looked like she was having so much fun in that scene, and just like the way they shot it with this was one of those moments I'm like, that's where you use the slow motion. Yeah. Give me the graceful elf taking on five people dual wielding, just like inject that right into my veins.
Love it. Galadriel and Halbrand have more conversations. You know, Galadriel reflects on like why she keeps fighting and how her friends tried to stop her from fighting because she was becoming the evil that she was fighting. And I do think that's an interesting idea of like that she has that self-awareness that she's like, I can't, you know, left unchecked, I might become that which I hate.
Yeah.
But she's also like, I keep fighting because I have to keep fighting. And it's like, oh, okay, well, that's not really a super satisfying answer, nor does she intend to stop, I should point out.
She's literally donning armor.
I'm like introspective about this, but I should stop. I should stop. But, you know, like she's not like that. So she's just like, got to keep fighting, even though it might lead to bad things happening. Maybe we'll see some of them happen. Some of those bad things happen during the course of the show. So
I think we might.
Anything else about the Galadriel storyline? I mean, eventually they decide to move forward sailing anyway, which is what we thought was going to happen at the end of the last episode. So
yeah, definitely thought that this would this episode would pick up the pace, and this is one of those things I think we talked about in the beginning. The pacing doesn't necessarily match our expectations, and maybe that's done intentionally, but yeah, definitely feels like we could have moved things along a little bit here.
There is an interesting scene where Isildur is talking to his friends and, you know, he's trying to like get on board the ship, and there's a whole subplot around that. But Isildur is marching to go to the ship, and he finally is able to convince his dad and everyone that he should have a place on there. And his sister, Aerion, is really upset. She's like anti-war. We should not.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should not go to war in Afghanistan kind of deal. And you had an interesting observation about the scene where Aerion is trying to like cry out to her brother.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So there's the whole, you know, the Farazan's son, Kemen subplot, where like Aarion is trying to convince Kemen. Kemen is trying to convince Farazan. Farazan basically pulls a "everybody out of my room, I control this thing." I thought that was a really, I thought that was a really well done scene, just kind of showing Farazan's control and influence in like a microcosm. I feel like we're probably going to see a little more of that if we go revisit Numenor in this season.
I'm just going to say that I really like that scene between Farazan and Kemen, because it is the first time in the show in which the dynamic between elves and men has been discussed at length. Like the whole time I'm trying to figure out, like, we're in episode 5 and I'm like, what is the dynamic between, like, why do they hate each other and why would they agree to do this? And Farazan explains, like, actually there's advantages, there's strategic advantage to us going and doing this, which I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought of that. Right.
Yeah. I thought that was a really well-written scene.
And that's what I was saying at the beginning, Don, about how I wish the show was either slower or faster. It's that kind of stuff that I wish we'd had more. Like the first season could have been just that, you know, of scenes like that, debating, discussing, and or figuring out ways to like ramp that up in intensity. But instead, we just get this one scene, which is pretty good between Farazan and Kemen. But
yeah, definitely anyway. Want to see more of that as the political intrigue continues. But yeah, the Aarion scene was really interesting to me, because I saw it as, you know, Isildur has this moment where, you know, Kemen's trying to destroy the boat and Isildur's trying to stow away and they fight and there's a lantern and the ship explodes and everything, or two of the ships explode because the fire goes from one to another and they lose two of them. And Elendil sort of says, all right, cool, you've proven your worth, let's get you here, I know you really want to, you did it. And I saw it as sort of like pageantry and gallantry for like the boys going off to war, but it very much reminded me of Tolkien's experiences in World War One, where like the thought of going off to war was very gallant and exciting and there's pomp and circumstance, and then we see Isildur's sister, Aarion, and she's crying because she knows that there's a chance her brother doesn't come back. And that is kind of heartbreaking and very true to life in what actually happened in Tolkien's life. He went off to war with a bunch of his friends, and a bunch of his friends didn't make it back. And
yeah,
I think that was a really, really poignant moment in the show.
Yeah, it's really interesting just because everyone's so gung-ho about it. And it's nice to have a reminder that, hey, actually, you're going to fight this battle. I think it's also kind of an indication that it's been really long time before any of these people have seen, you know, since any of these people have seen any fighting at all. Like, they probably don't understand what the horrors of war truly are.
No.
If so, they wouldn't be so gung-ho about going through it, probably, you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, you talked about the Kemen and Isildur subplot where he tries to blow up the shit, because Kemen is really not for this war as well. And that's a fairly legitimate viewpoint in the show too. Any other, so then the episode ends with them triumphantly sailing off 3 ships, not 5, into the sunrise or sunset at Numenor, off to Middle Earth, to the Southlands, to help the Southlanders out and defeat evil. Where the episode ends. Any other thoughts on the Numenor subplot?
One detail I did want to point out that I thought was kind of interesting, because they hadn't established it before. Kemen, when he's having that conversation with his dad, Farazan, refers to Muriel, the Queen Regent, as your cousin. And they hadn't previously established that. And that is true in the books. The Queen Regent, Muriel, is cousins with Farazan. They are related. So there's some familial blood there, and maybe some possible tension, because, and again, I'll come back to that Kemen Farazan scene, because it was so emblematic of like what I really liked.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
About this episode and one of those moments I was talking about at the beginning where I think the show can really shine. That was a really great scene for me. I thought like we got sort of an explanation of what's going on. We got some power dynamics. It was very sort of well crafted, I think.
Yeah, and I wish we'd had literally like 5 or 10x of that kind of thing. I honestly feel like the show needs to, again, slow down or speed up. Like, slow down and give us more of that, what those dynamics are. Or else what it risks doing is none of this stuff feels like it has any stakes, right?
Right.
Oh, sure, they're going to war. Great. I don't know what the implications of that are, you know? Numenor is going to Vinland. I barely understand why that's a good or a bad thing, you know? And I think that's kind of what the challenge of the show is right now, is to balance all these different plot lines, make them all feel significant, make them all feel like they have stakes, and also make it clear what the mission is. Top Gun.
Gotta make it clear what the mission is.
All right.
Gotta know what the mission is.
All right. I think that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of Decoding TV. Find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Also find us on Twitter, TikTok, YouTube. At Decoding TV is our username. We'll see you on all of those places. In the meantime, he is Don Marshall. I'm David Chen. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.